Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. Journalist, writer, and producer Edward Girardet joins us to discuss his latest book, Killing the Cranes, a reporter's journey through three decades of war in Afghanistan. It's just out from Chelsea Green Press. He's had a distinguished career based in Paris for the Christian Science Monitor, U.S. News and World Report, and McNeil Laird NewsHour. He began covering Afghanistan months before the Soviet invasion of 1979. Just before we spoke with him about the book, the British consul in Kabul was the target of twin suicide attacks, which took place on the anniversary of Afghanistan's Independence Day from Britain in 1919. Edward Girardet is often described by the U.S. media as the man who met Osama bin Laden, which he discusses in Killing the Cranes. But the much larger discussion in the book is about the complexities of Afghan society and the seemingly endless U.S. and NATO presence there. Edward Girardet, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let me ask you first about the title, because it gave me the impression that, in a way, reminded me of the title of a poet's book during the Vietnam War era, and that was Lotus in a Sea of Fire. You know, just this fragile image. And we hear again now from you this idea of a fragile bird population, really. Much beloved, and that's what you wanted to name your book after. Just talk about that.
Yes, in fact, it is related to a poet, the son of Khalilullah, who was a great 20th century Afghan poet. And the son, Masoud Khalili, was actually wounded at the attack against the northern commander, Ahmad Shah Massoud. He got over 200 pieces of shrapnel in his body. He was there during the attack, which killed the northern leader by two al-Qaeda operatives. And I went to see Massoud, who was also very much a poet himself. And this is about 4 or 5 years later, 2004, 2005, in Kabul. And it was in late March, one of those very cold, beautiful evenings, night skies with thousands of stars. And we had spent the whole evening in his house talking about the current situation in Afghanistan and the future of Afghanistan. And one of the things which he pointed out was that it's not just the international community who have a responsibility in Afghanistan, it's also the Afghans themselves. But he was rather gloomy about what was happening, because obviously already by 2005, the security situation was worsening steadily in Afghanistan, more and more attacks by the Taliban and other insurgent groups, and also by the failure of a lot of Afghans and foreigners, whether American, British, Europeans, to really understand Afghanistan and understand what was needed or what is needed to end the war. And as he walked outside after this very long conversation, he looked up into the sky and he said, "You know, for me, the end of March was always the time when you could not hear the sound of your voice for the migrating cranes. These are the Siberian cranes that tend to winter in the wetlands of southern Afghanistan and Balochistan and Iran, and then in early spring fly northwards toward Siberia, toward Russia." And he turned to me and said, "You know, I have not heard or seen a single crane since being here." And for me, when I heard that, I realized that something drastic had happened. And then he said, "Have we even killed all the cranes?" And there was such sadness in his voice, and I just knew this was the title of a book. So I tried to adapt that.
Well, your book is full of instances where you really have brought the people that you encountered in this region to life for us. And so they're no longer these one-dimensional people on a given side. And I think that's one of the most powerful things that I got out of reading this. But this administration has had to contend with its predecessor, and so has translated its own policy initiatives, you know, sort of through the filter of the same people, right, that were working
right
under the Bush-Cheney operation. Which is more important, do you think, that aspect of it, or really the subculture of military intelligence and military personalities? I mean, is it politics or military that is really going awry in this part of the world?
That's a very good question. In fact, the other day I was in the UK at a wedding, and some of the people at the wedding were British Royal Marine officers on their way back to Afghanistan, to Helmand. And, you know, normally the British are pretty reticent about what they say in public, and particularly to journalists. And I was chatting with two of the young officers. They were in their early 30s, and they were extremely angry. And they said, we are being used as political tools. We're being asked to fight a war which makes absolutely no sense, and we're dying for it. And, you know, these are very much professional soldiers, and I was really stunned at the openness and the anger in their voices. And I think one of the things, you know, when you look at Afghanistan, for me, is that it's a totally unnecessary war. We failed during the 1980s and 90s to really understand what was happening in Afghanistan. We got involved, not because we loved the Afghans, but because we were trying to sock it to the Soviets with their own Vietnam. So we supported the Mujahideen, the Afghan resistance, but we also supported the resistance in a very unsavory manner, a misinformed manner. We supported Islamic extremists. The bulk of the guerrilla commanders during the 1980s who we supported were the favorites of the Pakistanis, the so-called military intelligence organization, ISI, who basically had their own agenda. And the CIA relied almost totally on ISI for their information and supported these extremists who went around killing, murdering, you know, Afghan moderates. They probably did more to undermine the war against the Soviets. And it's not that there was any lack of information available to the U.S. government at the time. There were some very well-informed State Department people who were pointing out, look, you cannot support these extremists the way we are because they will come back as monsters later on, which is precisely what happened. Then when the Soviets left, we dropped Afghanistan like a hot potato. And, of course, during this period, the battle for Kabul ensued. The extremists basically came into power. And by the events of September 11th, there had been warnings by people like Ahmad Shah Massoud, the Northern Alliance commander, by Abdul Haq, who was actually a very well-known Pashtun commander. There were a number of these top-rate guerrilla commanders who were considered to be moderates, and they had consistently warned the West about the emergence of these extremists. So by the time September 11th happened, and there was really no shortage of warnings, the response in the States was probably one which was not unexpected. There was obviously high emotion, a lot of anger, and people were looking for a scapegoat. But again, there were warnings that if you go in with massive bombing, you will not resolve the problem. What you're doing, in fact, is probably making it worse. And one of the biggest mistakes, I think, was that the Bush administration classified or regarded the Taliban as a terrorist organization exactly along the same lines as Al-Qaeda. And in fact, the Taliban, who consisted primarily of illiterate Afghans, who really didn't care what happened in world politics and probably had no idea what the Arabs and Al-Qaeda were doing in Afghanistan, the Americans were basically intervening in a civil war. The Taliban were one of the major factions involved in this very, very brutal civil war against Massoud. And by doing so, they riled up the Pashtuns, who are the tribal people in the eastern and southern areas. And basically this is one of the factors which led to a new war in Afghanistan.
And Massoud is mentioned in your book often, and you write about his enemy, Hekmat Yar. I think you called him H.
The Big H.
The Big H. And kind of this hugely well-known character in the whole region, Afghanistan, Pakistan, gaining power then from that U.S. support during the time that the Soviet war was going on and afterward. Now, so just explain why Massoud is relevant where Hekmat Yar is concerned.
Well, during the Soviet war, you had, to make it very brief, you had seven main political parties, resistance parties based in Pakistan, all totally reliant on the Pakistanis, the Americans, the Chinese, and others for their funding. And then you had what was known as the Commanders of the Interior. And these were more or less commanders, Afghans, who had risen up in their own regions and established themselves through their own credentials as being, you know, good commanders or effective commanders. A lot of them were not, but people like Massoud or Abdul Haq or Ismail Khan, who's in Herat, they all emerged as relatively and extremely competent commanders. Now, Massoud became known as the Lion of Panjshir because He was operating mainly in the north, and the Soviets had tried on a number of occasions with massive offensives to take out Massoud and fail. And Massoud basically developed a highly effective guerrilla strategy, and really is probably, if you look historically, alongside General Giap of North Vietnam or Tito in Yugoslavia, he was in a sense a mix, a Che Guevara character, who also, you know, who worked with the people. He was extremely effective as a commander, and also was a moderate, but knew how to play off the elders, the more conservative elements within his entourage. So his vision of Afghanistan was basically quite a moderate, modernistic one. He had schools running in his areas. These are boy and girl schools. And he also brought in the French doctors, who at the time were mainly women volunteer doctors who smuggled themselves in to Afghanistan. So he became quite a popular figure. Unfortunately, during the early 90s, when Hekmatyar was shelling Kabul and basically the fighting between Massoud, who was in charge, who had managed to take control of Kabul after the Soviets left and the communists fell, Hekmatyar was trying with massive Pakistani ISI support to take the capital. Over 50,000 people were killed in a 2 or 3 year period. And unfortunately for many Afghans, they regarded Massoud as being also partially responsible for this by allowing the battle for Kabul to take place in the city. But he basically established himself as one of these leading commanders who was not under the control of the Pakistanis or the Americans or the Saudis.
You know, it's interesting the way that you've described people. We hear about them in the news, but you've described Hamid Karzai, who we all know about, as an English-speaking Pashtun eager to please foreigners who spent a lot of time at the Pearl Continental Swimming Pool, where he swam laps and could meet Westerners socially. And we can only wonder who that would have meant. But so then we have Karzai. That's how his political life developed. And then we also have Zalmay Khalilzad, and he, too, an ethnic Pashtun, who at one point was working for the U.S. oil consortium Unocal and on a very key region, you know, the Turkmenistan region there, and a pipeline that a lot of Americans don't even realize is relevant to this whole matter. But so, you know, just talk about that development, too, of this other political culture springing out of this new policy initiative that just keeps coming and going on.
You know, basically, we went in after 2001 and tried to resolve everything in the manner that we thought was the best way, which meant a westernized approach. And unfortunately, Afghanistan does not work that way. And again, there were a lot of people who advised, go slow, don't throw money at this, work above all with local communities. But what we did instead, when I say we, I mean the Americans, the Europeans, British, the West, we decided there had to be a strong capital. And I think if you talked with a lot of, you know, people who knew Afghanistan well from the 70s, the 80s, 90s, the basic recommendation was, fine, you know, have a capital in Kabul, but basically the main input will come from the regions, and you've got to focus on the regions where the bulk of the population are. So we took Karzai, who was a Pashtun, spoke good English, and quite frankly, he's a charming man. He's delightful to have to meet at cocktail parties and whatnot, but he had no power. And I think this is also probably one reason why a lot of Afghans initially accepted him, because he had no power. They've always wanted to have their kings with no power, because Afghans regard themselves as kings amongst kings. Every Afghan has the right to speak, and everyone is equal. And that's what makes Afghanistan so extraordinary, I think. With Khalilzad, I mean, it was utterly astounding that they appointed an Afghan-American as the American ambassador, because not only did he have a history with the oil industry, and obviously there were some agendas there which were highly questionable for Afghanistan, but also Afghans did not regard him as an American. They regarded him as Afghan boy done well. And they all knew his baggage. They knew that he would favor his own people. And probably one of the greatest mistakes that Khalilzad did, which he imposed on Afghanistan, was to sideline the king, King Zahir Shah. Now, the king was this old man, this old doddering man, who really had no power whatsoever. But in the eyes of most Afghans, particularly the refugees, he represented a period of peace from the 1970s. He was no great king. I mean, he was not an exceptional man, but he did represent this era of peace. And he would have been the right figurehead to have to front the government and to allow actually something to happen as far as recovery was concerned. Because I think most Afghans, if you talk to them, they wanted peace. They didn't trust the warlords. They did not trust the politicians. They wanted a breathing space. And one of the organizations that perhaps, and I say perhaps, could have done that might have been the United Nations. I think a lot of Afghans would have been quite happy to have the United Nations sort of get things moving with a recovery effort, but with the king, the former king, as the sort of figurehead as long as he lived. And of course, he died not too long ago, and that opportunity was missed. So what happened was we brought in the warlords, and people realized nothing has changed. They're the same people back in power. It's all for money. It's all for power. And even amongst people within the capital who despise the Taliban, they began to loathe the international presence, which they have increasingly regarded as an occupation.
You're listening to Talk Nation Radio, and we're speaking with journalist Edward Girardet.
And I just want to read a little bit from page 123 of your book, and this chapter 6 is actually about refugees in part. And this, of course, is Killing the Cranes, a reporter's journey through three decades of war in Afghanistan. And this, on page 123, really sets the tone for the changes you watched, because you talked about the way that you could get through border regions. They're very highly dangerous today, you write, but back in those earlier days, I never felt nervous about roaming the tribal zones. Even in 2005, I was able to visit the Khyber Agency without too much concern. By 2008, however, the Pakistani army was fighting a major war against local Taliban and Al-Qaeda elements, including foreign fighters from countries such as Yemen, Chechnya, and Libya. Much of this took place in the NWFP, including Swat, a traditional tourist area. Now this you describe, finally, in this paragraph, as a World War II-style full-scale operation, something that you write would have been unthinkable before.
Absolutely. And I think what was extraordinary during the 1980s was that, in many senses, we were highly privileged to be able to step back into what was basically the 19th century. And that's what was so amazing about covering the war in those days, is that you would be moving from the 19th to the 20th centuries in a matter of days. You walked, you trekked through the villages, you went through tribal area in Pakistan. The tribal area, by the way, are areas where the government has no control, but would always have negotiated relations with the tribesmen. And the tribal people in those days supported the jihad in Afghanistan against the Soviets. So you could actually walk through, you had no problems really. There was what's known as the law of the Pathan, Pashtun Wali, which meant that they had to respect their visitors who came to their part of the world. So you could travel through these areas, and I kept thinking, you know, I wouldn't be able to pay for such a trip anywhere else. This is absolutely extraordinary. And we would stay in villages, sleep in mosques, drink tea, have meals. And of course, nowadays, there is absolutely no way you could do that. You would be either kidnapped, robbed, or killed probably within the first 2 or 3 days.
Let's talk about the violence that's going on right now in Afghanistan, because when you see something like that happen, what comes to your mind first, given what you know about this region as to these, you know, bombings in succession, and, you know, this is the British compound?
Yeah, I mean, that's the sad thing. During the Soviet era and possibly even during the 1990s, you did not have IEDs or booby traps or suicide bombers. That's a very new concept, which really only came in toward the end of the 1990s. And obviously, Massoud himself was killed by two suicide bombers, Al-Qaeda operatives. But what's happened now is that the majority of casualties amongst the military are the result of IED or suicide attacks. And also directed against the civilian population. For many Afghans, this was nothing new, because that's precisely what Hikmatyar did. He shelled ordinary Afghans in Kabul. The Soviets also, in their war, they killed, more than 1.5 million people died as a result of the Soviet war in one way or another, through bombings, through, you know, starvation, injuries. And nowadays, when you go through Kabul, I mean, every embassy, every military installation of ISAF or NATO, the walls are so high that you can't even see the buildings. And most, you know, foreign diplomats are unable to walk the streets of Kabul. They're not allowed out. You can't even go to a restaurant without, you know, armed escort. Now, what this means for the internationals is that you're losing touch with Afghans themselves. And many Afghans comment on this. I think Afghans themselves, they realize that there is a risk, but that's they're used to war. But I think what they're dismayed about is the fact that because of this very tight security situation, the international community has lost touch and does not really understand Afghanistan anymore. Now, of course, the insurgents, and I say insurgents as opposed to Taliban, because you've got the Taliban, you've got Hezbi Islami of Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, you've got the Haqqani Network, you've got various other opposition groups. There's no overall organization. The insurgents are deliberately attacking diplomats and ordinary Afghan civilians in order to send a message. They're trying to show that no matter what you do, you will not be safe. And this is, again, making it more difficult for the internationals to operate. And just recently, I mean, this attack now against the British Council compound, normally extremely well secured, shows that no one in Kabul is safe. So it's a very, very deliberate policy, and I think we're going to see this happen more and more in the weeks and months that come.
And one's reminded, of course, of the Green Zone in Iraq and how there were some instances where people breached the high security there, too, toward the latter part of the heavier U.S. presence and occupation of Baghdad.
Absolutely. But at the same time, remembering that the majority of international NGOs, the volunteer aid agencies, and local Afghan NGOs are not operating with armed guards or mercenaries. Their best security are the local communities. For example, you've got the Swedish Committee, which has about 5,000 local employees and only 8 expatriates, 8 foreigners. And they absolutely refuse to have armed guards because they say their best security is by working with the local communities. And I think this is the message for the long term, that unless you have this local support, and this includes, you know, talking with the insurgents, talking with NATO, talking with the government, talk with everyone. And as a soldier, if you're with NATO or the U.S. Armed Forces, you can't do that. I mean, you've got the enemy in front of you. You can have, you know, secret talks if you like. But it's not going to happen that way. So in a sense, what we're looking at is an extremely difficult situation whereby the insurgents are now playing the ground by realizing that the Americans and NATO have declared that they intend to be out or partially out by 2014, and they're just biding their time. I mean, that's what an effective guerrilla force does.
You do write about some of the people working in aid organizations and medical ones who were really affected when change occurred. And I'm just, again, reading from your preface on page 2, where you write, decades of conflict, competing worldviews, and outside interests had turned Afghanistan into a land where neither the Western-backed Kabul government nor the insurgents are in control, and basic humanity seems to have vanished.
Well, last August 2010, 10 international Afghan aid workers, including 2 Americans who've been working there for over 30 years and basically who dedicated their lives to Afghanistan, Tom Little and Dan Terry, they were brutally executed. They were captured and executed one by one. And I think this shocked a lot of us because the message which came across was that even these people who have got good relations, I mean, both of them were fluent Dari speakers. They had lived in Afghanistan. In fact, the Tom Little family had lived in Kabul during the entire Soviet era and only left when the Taliban basically forced them out. They were Christians, but they were not missionaries. They were not proselytizing. And that was very shocking because these were the people, the very people, who had an enormous amount of trust with local Afghan communities. And, you know, they'd been working in Nuristan, which is a highly mountainous, rugged area. They'd spent 2 weeks providing dental and eye care to the 50,000 local people there over 2 weeks, and they were just leaving when they got accosted by these armed men. We don't quite know who they were, and they were killed. So, you know, you do have extraordinary individuals who've been working there for years, but even for them now, it's a toss-up. You know, what do you do? But I think organizations such as the International Committee of the Red Cross or Médecins Sans Frontières and others, they're still trying not to panic, and they're trying to work locally and work in the rural areas, and they're constantly talking with those local communities. But, you know, anything can happen.
You're writing, too, at one point in Foreign Policy, the magazine, July 18th, I believe it was, and you're saying, you know, after more than three decades of targeted killings, is there anyone left alive who can actually run Afghanistan? That's in your piece, Assassination Nation. It's like there's a lot of killing going on, and what can the possible outcome be that leaves Afghanistan in the kind of condition it needs to be in to be stable if America does ever leave?
Yes, I mean, I think one of the problems is that we have, for such a long time, regarded Afghanistan as being a black and white issue, and it's really all grays. And very often, the leaders, maybe local people, you basically have to consult with everyone, the local villagers. You can talk about talking with the Taliban, but who are the Taliban? And ironically as well, the drones have been extremely effective in killing upper-level commanders. But what's happening with that is while they're wiping them out, which from the military point of view may sound effective, they are also killing the very people they should be negotiating with. And the newer generation of Afghans who are taking their places, these are 21, 22-year-olds, many who were brought up in Pakistan in the madrasas and the religious schools, and they no longer have any sense of loyalty to their own country or to their regions because they've been brought up outside and often by foreign, you know, mainly Arab teachers. And these people are much more hardline than the elder generation. So it's going to become much more difficult to even talk to these people because their idea of succeeding is to die in the jihad, you know, if possible, killing an infidel. So on the one hand, we're succeeding militarily against these individuals, but on the other, we're actually wiping out any possibility of talking and bringing an end to the conflict. And with the, you know, a lot of the local villagers, they are now caught between two, three, four sides. No Afghan is going to tell you, unless they really, really trust you, what they think. And, you know, I've talked to American officers or British who've gone in and they say, oh, you know, we talk to the villagers. We know what their problems are. They don't, because they still have a gun. And every Afghan family, and there was nothing different during the Soviet war, every Afghan family has one foot with one camp and the other with another, and if possible, two or three more feet, if they had them, with other groups. And because they have to, their issue is survival. They know that the Americans, the British and the Germans, the NATO will go one day, but that the Taliban and the other insurgent groups will remain. So they're also looking ahead to the future, in a sense, of what's going to work out for me. And every local leader, tribal leader, or regional leader, his main concern is the best for his people. That's all they care about. They care less about Afghanistan, but it's a survival technique. This is what makes Afghanistan so difficult and why you cannot go in there with a short-term perspective, quick fixes. They don't work. You have to basically think, you know, what can we do to help? We can't do it for them. It's got to be the Afghans themselves. You know, having said all that, Afghans still will talk to each other. What's always struck me is that you have Afghans who will say, oh, that's my cousin over there, he is a Talib. Or that's so-and-so, he's, you know, my third cousin, and he works for NATO. You just wonder, well, where is this all going? And I'm not saying that those of us who have been there for a long time or been in and out for a long time understand it better. I think we just realize how complicated it is and that there are no easy solutions. And I think what has been striking with the way the West has operated with Afghanistan, when I say the West, a lot of the governments, is we've come in with most extraordinary arrogance. So we know what's best, and it doesn't work that way. And I think anyone who's dealt with a guerrilla conflict realizes you cannot impose things from the outside.
Journalist, writer, and producer Edward Girardet. His new book is Killing the Cranes, A Reporter's Journey Through Three Decades of War in Afghanistan. And we'll hear the second half of this interview next time. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated with Pacifica Network. TalkNationRadio.org is our website. Our music is by Fritz Heed.